Yeah, the other man said. He's one of those self-anointed swamis. Well, hey there, folks. How you doing? Keith Tyler here, bringing you the Mystery Hour, right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Absolutely thrilled to be bringing you the show. Thanks for joining me. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Gary Phillips brings us our first story, and it's called Dr. Morbilius. Both men were surprised to see the other after the door swung inward. Well, I'll be doggone, Roy Ingram breathed, looking at the younger man up and down. Harry Ingram gaped at his father as he stood several inches back from the threshold. By habit, he'd positioned himself on the wall next to the door where he'd knocked. His father's age was creeping into his features, his face starting to be lined, and his graying hair receding some at the temples. But he was still solidly built and didn't have much of a paunch. He wore khakis and a short-sleeved shirt. "Well, no sense standing out there on ceremony," the older man said. "Come on in and sit a spell." He was holding a can of beer and stepped aside to let his son into the apartment. "Would you like a cold one?" "Yeah, sure." The nightly news was playing on the television. The younger Ingram took in what there was in the way of furnishings in the apartment. All of it looked worn and must have come with the place, he determined. There was this front room with two chairs, a couch, the TV and a cart, and a small round table with a drawer. Off to one side of the room, along a wall, was an open door leading into a bedroom and where there must have been a bathroom. There was no overhead lighting, but a few lamps were dispersed about. He stepped closer to the round table, upon which resided one of the lamps, and a hardback book lay near it. The book was titled On the Nature of the Metaphysics of Change. Tapping the cover with his index finger, the younger man said over his shoulder, "It's kind of a step up from the sports page you was always reading, isn't it?" He wasn't going to mention the book seemed like something his girlfriend, Anita Clare, might read. Harry wasn't about to let this man, who left him and his mother when he was in junior high, know anything about his life. "Hey, can't a man broaden his horizons?" Harry sat on the couch, facing the television. His father had been at the refrigerator in the kitchenette. He removed a can of East Side Lager. He pulled the tab open and came over holding the fresh one and the one he had been working on. Momentarily, he was before his seated son. He then handed him the beer. An uncomfortable silence descended as the two men, related by blood, separated by years, regarded one another. "Here's how," Roy Ingram said, holding the can out. Hesitating, Harry nonetheless raised his can and knocked it against the other's beer. As he took a sip, his father sat on the opposite end of the couch. There was no coffee table. Harry put the beer beside the couch on the thinning carpet. "How'd you find me?" Roy said. He had his beer before his mouth, eyes on the TV screen. President Johnson had been filmed earlier today holding an impromptu press conference on a golf course. He was testily answering questions about a recent offensive driven by the Viet Cong near the U.S. combat base in Dong Ha, Vietnam. "Well, I wasn't looking for you. Didn't even know you were back around." The older man waited, keeping his attention on a commercial which had just begun. The man from GLAAD, with his sterling silver hair and creased white trench coat, arrived in his helicopter-powered rowboat to deliver the premium sandwich bag to a stressed-out housewife. "The fridge," Harry said, pointing his jaw at it. "You missed your first payment." this some kind of article you're working on for Zodis?" the elder Ingram huffed, drinking more of the lager. The department store was where the appliance had been purchased. "Nah, I do some process serving when there's dry periods in between the pieces I write and take snaps for." He purposely didn't mention, since last year he'd also been building up his private eye practice. He'd even looked into the requirements about obtaining a license. "How do you know about me writing?" he added. "Well, you can get the Sentinel out of town, you know," the elder Ingram said. "You've been on TV, too, I think." "Have you been back in town before now?" "Well, sort of. I've been in and out of California over time." "Never staying long, though." A frown, then he said, "How much money can you make serving papers on a deadbeat refrigerator bill?" "Oh, it's one of three I have to take care of." Nodding, he said, "Okay, I get it. You found me by accident." Harry lifted a shoulder. He hadn't used his real name when he took out the layaway. "It belongs to a distant relation of me and you," Roy said. "You met him once when you was a kid." The name on the account was Norman Sams. Harry had no memory of him. Silently, each stared at the television for several minutes. "Well, I'm not one to cry about milk over the dam," Roy eventually offered, "or however that saying goes." He finished grinning at his mangling of the cliché. "No, neither am I." His old man turned to look at him, draining his beer. When Harry got out of the service, he'd received a letter from his father. He'd said he was glad his son made it through the war. He'd also mentioned he was working in an oil field. He'd withheld a return address, but the postmark had been San Antonio in Texas. That was the state where he'd moved when he'd left Harry and his mother. Roy had started another family, and Harry had two half-siblings who he later met. His father said, "Seems we ought to, do something, considering us running into each other, no matter why. How about dinner? I can rustle up something. I got some chops in the fridge you came to collect on." He smiled again. An anger bubbled in Harry's stomach. "No, you don't have to go out of your way." "It's not like that, Harry." "It's exactly like that, Roy." He got up, wishing to be done and on his way. "We ain't having a reunion. You didn't look me up since you got back to town. And don't say it's 'cause I moved from where I was living in Woodlawn. I'm in the white pages if you bother to check." He got the folded over paperwork from the inside pocket of his sport coat, letting it flutter onto the couch. "Ignore it if you want, but here's the demand letter." He started for the front door. "I've been laying low on purpose, Harry," his father said. On the other man walked away. "The only thing you're laying low from is whatever chick you were last shacked up with, who's probably looking to carve her initials into you." Over the next few years, after returning from Korea, he'd received other letters from the man as well. The postmark indicating in late 61 his father had begun moving around, the impression being he'd left his second family as well. The younger Ingram went back out to the hallway and headed toward the stairs with its rickety banister to take him down and out of the apartment building. He was descending when he noted the footfalls at his back. "Come on, don't be like this. We're family," Roy Ingram said. "Yeah, that's pretty much an accident of birth," Harry replied. "You know, maybe it's a sign you showed up on my door, son. I do know what you've been up to. The hawkshawing, I mean." Out the glass-inset front door the son went, Roy Ingram following. "How would you know about that?" Harry said, turning to look at him. "Elamina told me. I saw her when I was passing through Tulsa, before my current situation, I mean. Fact, well, Well, never mind, he said, waving a hand and letting the rest of his sentence drift away. Harry's mother had been out to see him and met Anita Clare, who he'd bragged to her about, his lady love. That was last December, around Christmas time. She'd stayed with them, and naturally, in their conversing, his recent activities had come up. He said, "What do you mean, your current situation? Unemployed?" The elder Ingram was looking past Harry's shoulder. He swiveled around as both watched a cream-colored Chrysler Newport with gold trim and gold wire wheels pulled to the curb behind the late 50s Thunderbird with a damaged fender, both vehicles in front of the apartment building. The engine shut off. A woman in her 20s, in a dark blue hip-hugging skirt and matching coat, her frizzy hair held back from her forehead, got out of the driver's side. She came around the car and opened the rear door facing the sidewalk. Out stepped a slender man whose ethnicity Harry couldn't place. He could have been in his 40s or 50s. He was dressed in a dark pinstripe suit, open collar with a light blue shirt underneath. Owlish glasses framed his lean, elongated face, and his straight black hair was done in what they called a Caesar style, or so Harry recalled from the picture chart in his barber shop showing the various types of hairstyles available. "Dr. Morbilius," Roy Ingram said, nodding slightly. "Hello, Roy," the man in the round glasses said. "My apologies for coming by unannounced. But that matter which concerns you and me, seems there's been a recent development." There was a calm, reassuring quality of his way of speaking. The woman stood nearby, hands clasped in front. The one called Morbilius addressed Harry. "And who might you be, sir?" He leaned his head forward, studying his face. "A cousin, is it?" "Nope, just a guy passing through." He took another look at his father and went to his car, a Falcon Squire station wagon. Whatever the heck his father was up to, he sought to put it out of his mind. Despite his curiosity about this doctor, he must have something to do with his father's current reading material, he guessed. The name was familiar to him, but he didn't know in what context. If Roy got in contact later, maybe he'd find out, he mused while driving away. The second document to be served was a set of divorce papers to a machinist in El Monte. He accepted the document quietly. The third person he had to serve owned a sailboat. This individual had been delinquent on more than one payment. The man's name was Harvey Warrens, and he lived in the port town of San Pedro. He worked in a Todd shipping yard, also located there. It was now past 6 in the evening. Warrens wasn't at home. Ingram had been out this way on several assignments over the years, had even been to the ABC Club on Beacon Street with Anita not that long ago. He knew the bars, the proletarians, his old lady might say, frequented. He spotted Warren's in the second place he tried, the Long Shore. Ingram did his freelance work for Galton Process Services and Legal Papers. In their file on Warren's were photostats of his driver and boat licenses. "Get the heck out of here," Warren said after Ingram braced him. There was a half-empty glass of beer and an empty shot glass before him. "I don't accept you coming in here and trying to take my boat from me," he wheezed into Ingram's face. He flipped the demand notice onto the bar top. It landed on a wet spot, soaking through the paper. "Yeah, what right have you got to bother a man after a hard day on the job?" the guy sitting next to Warren's asked, glaring at Ingram. He, too, had been enjoying a shot and a beer. Both had the veined hands of working men. "I can dig that, I do," Harry began, "but I've got a job to do as well." "A jackal's job," the friend sneered. "Whatever, man. Ingram made to leave. He wanted a drink too, but that would have to be when he got back to L.A. proper. "No, it ain't whatever," Warren's drinking companion grabbed Ingram's arm. Ingram yanked his arm loose, nearly toppling the other man off his stool. "The heck it isn't." "Take it easy, Georgie," Warren's advised. Behind the bar, the bartender was eyeing them as he continued drying a mug. "What?" Georgie said, back firmly on his stool. "Like this chump from the court has the right to waltz in here like his crap don't stink and tell you about money owed?" He squinted at Ingram, shaking a finger at him. "Bet you is behind on your car note and you'll use your blood money to catch up." He rocked back, then forward. "It's a shame, is what it is." "Be like your pal and have another beer."
"Yeah, why don't I tell it to the chappie while I'm at it?" Georgie snorted.
"You were in the service?" Ingram said, hedging for a way to lower the temperature. He wasn't opposed to putting a fool in his place, but why split a knuckle if he didn't have to? Guess all the Zen Anita was always centering was rubbing off on him. "Darn right, froze my nuts off in Korea."
"Me too."
"Ah, baloney." 01 Company, attached to the 7th Infantry Division, Harry said, eyes steady on Georgie. "Ate those hard, dry little biscuits in our sea rations at the meat grinder of Hill 19.
He absorbed this.
"Okay. Okay, then." To Warren's, he said, "I hope you can work it out about your boat."
"Yeah, sure."
Ingram gave them a half wave and headed for the exit. And where he'd parked. Back in his part of town, he entered his empty house in the Crenshaw area. Anita Clare wasn't home. Her mother had wrenched her knee badly, so the daughter had driven out to Riverside that morning to help her around the house for a few days. Being able to use some of her sick leave from her job as an aide to Councilman Tom Bradley. Even as various postmortems were still rolling out about the Watts riots from last year, there was talk that Bradley might challenge conservative Democratic Mayor Sam Yorty for his job in 1969. After assembling a dinner from leftover spaghetti and a remaining piece of fried chicken, Ingram straightened up in the kitchen, where he'd been scanning through last week's Sentinel, the Black Weekly and the early edition of the Herald Examiner from that morning. Bunching the newspapers together and folding them over, he noticed a small display ad in the Sentinel's classified ad section. He smiled thinly as he read it. The ad announced the regular Saturday morning meetings of the Adepts of Olam, and all were welcome. Not only would enlightenment be gained, but Dr. Mobilius was available for private consultations. The Adepts' address was on Broadway. In the living room, Ingram brought the phone over on its long cord and sat in his easy chair. Thumbing through his address book, he found the listing he was looking for and made a call to Wesley Crossman. He was the Sentinel's Metro editor and the journalism instructor at Los Angeles City College.
"Hey, Wes, it's Harry."
"Yeah, I know I'm bothering you at home, but wasn't there a piece on this Dr. Morbilius cat not too long ago in the paper?"
"Yeah," said the other man. "He's one of those self-anointed swamis who combines all sorts of religious teaching from Santeria to Islam to sprinklings from hippies like Ginsburg and those guys. Now, this wasn't in the article because Leon is kind of, well, partial to him, but I'm pretty sure the name Morbilius Mama gave him was Michael Carter."
The Leon referred to was the paper's owner, Leon Washington. Crossman's continued talking.
"I also seem to recall he worked here at Keenan Chemicals before he started calling himself by his mystical name," he chuckled.
"He was a chemist?"
"Yeah, I don't remember. Why all of a sudden you're curious about him?" Ingrid filled him in as to why he was asking. "Is he trying to run his sideshow con and get money out of your father?" Crossman asked over the line. "The image of where his father was living in mind," he answered. "If he's got any scratch, he's hiding it pretty darn good. Nah, that can't be it. From what you said, though, it sounds like he came back to L.A. because of Morbilius. I find it hard to believe he's all of a sudden got the Holy Ghost or whatever they're calling it among the Olamites," Ingram joked. "Well, it has been years since you saw him last," Crossman observed. "Yeah, maybe he came back because of some woman and she's one of the members." "Is that what you think?"
"I don't know what I don't know," Ingram said.
"Gonna find out?"
Ingram grunted.
"They meet regularly, don't they?"
"Yeah, they do. Today was Thursday."
"Yeah, go check him out. See if you can take a few snaps. If nothing else, maybe you'll see your father and you can have a cup of coffee with him afterward."
"The prospect of that isn't exactly an enticement."
"Up to you, soul brother."
"You ain't fooling nobody, Wes. You know I have to scratch the itch."
"You're not comparing me to a mosquito, are you?"
"Never," Ingram drawled.
"This is why one day there'll be a comic strip about you, The Adventures of the Sleuth of South Central."
"You know, has a ring to it," Ingram commented laconically.
"Talk to you soon."
"Yeah, you will."
On Saturday morning, Ingram arrived a few minutes before 10 when the meeting was scheduled to begin. The Adepts of Olam was a storefront with two bay windows bracketing the front door. The main space was spare and clean, the linoleum worn but freshly scrubbed. Folding chairs were set up and they faced a freestanding lectern. Along one wall was a long table covered in a patterned cloth. Various religious symbols in pewter and porcelain were placed there. An ankh, a cross, and a star and crescent were among the objects. Smoke from a covered silver incense burner rose toward the ceiling. There was also a small gong and padded paddle. Ingram wasn't surprised to see a few white folks entering with the mostly black folks in attendance. Morbilius's flock must pass out flyers in coffee houses. Behind the lectern was a door and a back area. This opened and out stepped Morbilius, the woman who'd been driving him the other day, and another man, burly in a dark blue sport coat. He didn't see his father. Whether Ingram was disappointed or relieved, he wasn't sure. The man in the sport coat took a folding chair and placed this off to the side. In this way, he could keep watch on the assembled, the front door, and the second door. Morbilius regarded Ingram, exchanging words with the woman. Harry hadn't brought along a camera, after all, and he sat toward the rear of the row of chairs. The woman sounded the gong, and the small talk among the gathered quieted. Leaning forward, both hands gripping the side of the lectern, Morbilius began.
"I am pleased to see we have a full house this glorious Saturday morning in our metropolis. For surely as the sun shines, the rays of renewal and revival are upon us, one and all."
"As it will be," a few responded in unison. The talk Morbilius gave was as Crossman had indicated. He began by using a parable from the Bible of Joseph and his family leaving Canaan to live in Egypt. How this physical manifestation of travel was symbolic of the inner journeys we were on to achieve in this world and the next. Further aligning one's thoughts in harmony with unseen yet still perceived currents of positive energies flowing around us can lead to physical well-being. Thereafter, he slipped into a lesson from the Quran and a little later used a more contemporary frame of reference. Morbilius regularly stepped from behind the lectern to pace and circle back to stop in front of the seated. As the great middleweight champion Sugar Ray Robinson observed, rhythm is everything. Every move you make starts with your heart, and that has to be in rhythm, or you're in trouble. For it is about the heart that we must attune to that which the universe has manifested for us. You see, he said, wagging an index finger, this is not going on about apple pie in the sky, in the great by and by. The aim of our humble avocation is about realizing a spiritual and practical growth here and now. You can't focus on the realm beyond this realm if your belly is empty, as is the cupboard. Morbilius pointed eastward. If the steel and auto companies won't hire us because of our hue or our chosen religion observations, then we must seek to overcome those barriers. Whatever higher entity you believe in, they will only help you if you help yourself. Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, but, he added, stepping out yet again from behind the lectern, Caesar should darn well deliver unto the polis, the people. There was applause and nods of agreement. It is clear this means also that those who say they speak for us, our so-called elected representatives, must be moving the community forward, be it to get a traffic signal at a crossing to ensure the safe passage of our children, or who will watch the watchers who sneak and pry, infiltrate and obfuscate. He paused, eyes stark behind the lenses. You know who I mean. There was more head nods and favorable murmuring. After 40 minutes or so, Morbilius ended his talk, thereafter encouraging questions and comments from the audience. Ingram summed up the doctor's approach as a combination of the Disciples for Community Defense, a socialist-leaning community group organizing around local empowerment issues, and the Nation of Islam, which to him was quasi-religious and black nationalist. At 11:15, the meeting broke up, with some people exiting, and others hanging around chatting with each other or Morbilius. At some point, a coffee urn and fixings had been set up. Several were drinking the fresh brew in styrofoam cups, which Ingram had lately been seeing more of, replacing paper cups. "Did you find the presentation of interest, Mr. Ingram?" the woman who'd driven Morbilius had come up beside him. "He's got some good points," he allowed. "Are you working on a story about us?" she asked. Clearly once they knew who he was. They'd done their homework on him. "No, I was curious about you all since I saw you with my father the other day. I assumed I'd see him here this morning." "Yes, I did too. I'm going to have some coffee. Would you like some?" "No, I had plenty when I got up, but why not?" "Milk and sugar? Just a little milk, please." "Coming right up." Off she went. He looked around for Mobilius, but didn't see him. The man in the sport coat and now stationed himself and his chair alongside the door leading to the rear. Apparently that's where Morbilius's office, or however he referred to his sanctum, was located. Soon the woman was back. She handed him some coffee. "Thank you." He took a sip. "My name is Trudy." She knocked her cup against his, studying him. "Good to meet you, Trudy. Guess you already know I'm Harry. You intended to try and make up for lost time with your father?" "He told you about us." She pursed her lips. "No, not really. But I could hear the regret in what he didn't say." "Hm," was all he could manage to utter. Now the bodyguard came over. "Mr. Ingram, Dr. Morbilius would like to have a word with you."
"Did he use telepathy to tell you that?"
"What?" he said crossly.
"This way," Trudy said, smiling.
"Okay."
Starting forward, there was a leaden quality to Harry's footsteps, as if he needed sleep.
Trudy had a hand under his crooked arm as she guided him past the inner door the bodyguard opened. In here was carpeting and indirect lighting and paneling on the walls. Seated behind his desk, Morbilius, his fingers tented, regarded Ingram, who was assisted to sit heavily in a Rococo-style chair before him.
"How good to see you, Roy's offspring again," Morbilius said.
"Yeah, good old Roy," Ingram snickered. The coffee. They doped him, he realized.
"Why did you come here today?" Morbilius asked, light glinting off his owlish lenses.
"Well, like I told Trudy, curious is all."
"That amazing photo of yours from last year. What a tremendous service you did for our community, Harry. Showing the power structure for what it is."
He meant the shot Harry had taken during the Watts riot of the police shooting down an unarmed man, Faraday Zinnem of the Disciples.
"Isn't that what you want to do? Shake things up?"
He grinned. Trudy was there beside Ingram and was handing him the cup of coffee.
"Have another taste, Harry. This is a special blend designed to soothe, not agitate."
Ingram's first impulse was to slap the cup away, but that would no doubt earn him a dust-up with the bodyguard. And he was feeling a tad sluggish to engage him at the moment. Trudy, too, looked fit and would likely join in on beating him about the head while Morbilius delighted in his predicament. He took the coffee and sipped. His arm then went slack, and he let the drugged coffee spill on himself and drip to the carpeting. Ingram's head lowered.
"Excellent," Morbilius intoned, a squeak from his chair as he rose from behind the desk. "Let's let Harry have his nap while we attend to our permanent business with the madman."
"Lightweight," the bodyguard said, kicking Ingram's thigh.
"Now, now, Rennie," Morbilius advised.
"Should we tie him up?" Trudy said.
"Oh, no need. He'll be out for hours, and we'll have returned by then. Certainly Roy can smooth things over with his estranged."
The three left, locking the door. Ingram opened his eyes and spat out the coffee he hadn't swallowed. He didn't feel bad staining the doctor's carpet and got up but was still fuzzy in the head. There was a restroom through the office, and he splashed water on his face at the sink. This still didn't bring him fully awake. He looked around and spotted a tea cart in the corner with which there were several items, including a paring knife. He picked up the knife. Kneeling at the wall socket, he took in a breath and inserted the blade. The resulting electrical surge caused his arm to jerk, but he was shocked back to clarity. He rose. The door was solid, not hollow core. He was pretty sure he couldn't ram his shoulder against it to make it break open. There was a small window in the bathroom for ventilation, but not big enough to squeeze through. The lock's faceplate on the door was secured by hex-headed screws, so he couldn't use the head of the knife to turn them. Looking about, there was a shelf containing several civic awards Morbilius and his organization had accumulated. One of them had a heavy base. He used this as a hammer to do some damage to the faceplate. Ingram managed to separate the plate from the wood and used his hand to pull it further away. Thereafter, he was able to reach in with a knife and manipulate the lock mechanism. It hadn't taken too long to get out of the office, but he knew that after the dose, wherever the three were heading, he wouldn't be able to tail them. As he assumed, the main room was empty, the front door was also locked, but this faceplate had slotted screw heads. He undid these. Then he realized he should do what any self-respecting private eye would do before he got out of there. He reversed course and went back into Morbilius's office. The desk had a phone and a few loose sheets of notes on it. The handwriting was precise. The drawers were also locked, but it wasn't much to overcome.
There were various papers in the big drawer, notes for lectures, a few clippings about the adepts, an invoice for a brake job from a nearby service station, and so on. It was in one of the side drawers he found something of interest. It turned out to be Morbilius's leather-bound notebook. Ingram paged through it and found more of the flawless handwriting. Ingram was reminded how in junior high Mrs. Jurgens could only shake her head regretfully as she tried mightily to improve his penmanship. Morbilius had made various observations about the various suckers. He'd say clients, Ingram was sure. He was counseling. Finally, deeper into the notes, he saw a couple of mentions of his father regarding a woman named Camille Rinaldo. There were several recent notations about Ingram Sr.'s supposed spiritual advice to her. The main idea, he gleaned, had been to convince her the banks would fail again. He found her name and address in the white pages taken from the bottom shelf of the tea cart. Back in his Falcon, Ingram looked up Camille Rinaldo's address in his Thomas guide. The location was in Benedict Canyon. He wondered how long it would take him to get there, but was thankful that at this time of day the traffic was light. Where he could, he went over the speed limit, and he ran more than one red light. Under half an hour later, Ingram was on Sunset Boulevard driving through the West Hollywood area. About 12 minutes later, even once getting turned around in the hills, he pulled to a stop at the correct address, near Morbilius's distinctive car. The stone Tudor-style mansion with its interspersed stained-glass windows on both stories was set back from the street atop a slope of emerald wet lawn. The green swath was sparkling from a recent shower. The front door was locked. Behind him, Ingram heard a car slow down. It didn't take a medium for Ingram to figure what was up. The driver had to be curious as to why a black man was in the area. He pretended to knock on the door, halting his knuckles an inch or so from the wood. He was hoping whoever was in the car assumed he was there reporting for work. The car moved on. Ingram quit the porch, which stretched the width of the front of the house and was bordered by the balustrade, past an explosion of shrubbery to the side of the home, where there was a walkway leading to the rear of the house, where a pool and back house were partially visible down the way. The muffled report of a gun and a thump came from inside the house. Ingram halted, tense and listening for more. It didn't seem to him from the sound that the gun was big bore, but a .22 could easily send you to your grave. In a matter of moments, the side door banged open outwardly. The door was inset in a shallow alcove up a short set of steps. Out came Rennie, the bodyguard, holding a hand to his bleeding chest. He was glassy-eyed and he lost his footing, tripping off the step and onto the concrete. He groaned but was moving. He hadn't noticed Ingram. Ingram looked into the street. So far, no other cars were driving along. He went to the wounded man, who now was sitting up on the wall near the steps. "What the heck's going on?" "Oh, it's all messed up, is what," Rennie breathed. "Double-crossed us."
"Morbilius?"
"The sun," he said indignantly. More sounds came from deeper within the house, though no further gunshots.
I'm betting you don't want an ambulance showing up," Ingram said.
"Who are you telling? Sure as heck isn't going to go back inside that house."
Ingram was already on the steps. "Who has a gun?"
"Jonas. Oh, and Trudy. He's going to make it like these crazy spooks got out of hand and he had to deal with them to protect his mother."
"Jonas must be the son," Ingram assessed. "Is my father in there?"
"No, we already done his part."
Vague inklings as to what his con was about started to connect. He should turn around now and leave this place and these chumps to their troubles. But sure shooting, the fallout after this was over was going to affect his father, landing him in jail at the least, he bet. If it was up to him, he'd leave Roy on his own to sink or swim. He might feel guilty about turning his back on him for a week or so, but he'd get over it. The problem was, at some point, he'd have to come clean to his mother. He'd let the old man down. She might get salty about such. Now that would bother him. He went inside. He hoped Rennie managed to get away, though if caught, he'd dummy up. Ingram didn't want the law involved either. He entered a spacious kitchen, including pots overhead and pans like in pictures he'd seen in magazines. Drops of blood stood out on the polished pavers. Harry was aware he was leaving his prints around, but no sense dwelling on that. At the moment, was a minor matter. Not getting shot was foremost in his mind. The swing door leading out into the other parts of the house had a porthole window. He looked through this, but didn't see anyone moving around. Cautiously, Ingram pushed the door open. "You better get your butt out of here," a man's voice said. "Not without the doctor," a woman answered. "The charlatan stays with me." The voices came from him upstairs. "Once your mother is awake, you're cooked," Trudy said. "She won't believe you over me. Sure about that, Jonas?" Jonas didn't answer. Chancing his way into the large dining room, a deep pile of the rug helped to cover his movements. He got to a set of partially open pocket doors. Looking through these, he saw the main staircase. More blood was on the treads. Back in the kitchen, he opened a door, revealing the servants' stairs. Removing his shoes to lessen the sounds of his footfalls, he arrived at the landing and, ascending the servants' stairs further, gained the second floor. Ingram put his shoes back on. Before him was a wide hallway with arches and columns, as fitting with the mansion's architecture. Not far from him, to his right along the wall, was a door ajar. From what he'd overheard, another room up ahead must be occupied. Trudy and the mother in one, probably the master bedroom, and Jonas and Morbilius in the other. He also figured the master bedroom was at the far end of this open hallway. That way the owner could leave her bedroom and arrive at the main staircase, not having to pass the set of lesser stairs. The hinges of the slightly open door were closest to the stairs. The door canted inward. Ingram stepped further into the hallway, digging a quarter out of his pocket. He threw it hard against the door. "Hey!" Jonas demanded from within the room. "What the heck are you up to?" Confirming who was in what location, Ingram removed his shoes again and returned to the kitchen. Looking at the numerous tin containers on the counter beside the sink, he found the one he was looking for. He also took a dish towel draped on the handle of the stove and laid it open on the counter, glad the cloth was sizable. Soon he was back on the second floor again, shoes back on. Back against the wall, he slid forward, slowly toward the open door. Getting closer, he saw a nick in the wood from a bullet. That's why Jonas wasn't at the crack. Was Trudy watching him? Ingram got closer, having one chance to pull this off. He made a guttural sound. There was movement from inside the room. He made the sound again. "What's your gal up to?" Jonas said, to who Ingram assumed was Morbilius. The soothsayer didn't answer. Ingram said, "Oh no," stomping on the carpeted floor. A gun thrust out the opening and Ingram pushed the door inward. He brought the loosely tied dish towel up and around as Jonas reacted, bringing the gun level. He struck him in the face with a bunch towel with a flower inside. The stuff exploded in a white cloud, causing Jonas to cough and temporarily obscuring his vision as the gun went off. Ingram had moved to the side, grabbing the man's gun arm and holding it upright, using the rudimentary jiu-jitsu first learned in basic training and improved upon more recently in a self-defense class at the Y. He threw Junis over his shoulder and onto the floor while holding and twisting the gun arm. Morbilius had been sitting in a chair and was up, lunging toward the two. Ingram was faster, and now had the gun, a snub-nosed revolver. "Take it easy, Chandu," he wisecrack. "Who are you?" Junis said, getting up off the floor. He was a medium-built white man with sandy-colored hair. His face and shirt were dusted with flour. Ignoring him, Ingram said to Morbilius, "You want to get Teddy in here, or you want me to leave so I can do a story worthy of Bronze Trills? It'll make you famous, but darn sure not the way you want." Morbilius held up his hands, palms out. "We can reach a reasonable accord. I'm not interested in bilking Mrs. Rinaldo, though I guess you two are." The son regarded him glumly. Morbilius started to walk out. Ingram said, "And don't think I won't shoot a woman if she comes in here like she was Calamity Jane." Morbilius continued out. Ingram scanned the room. They were in a study with dark wood and several padded chairs about. There was also a wet bar and a fireplace. A desk to one side of the room had a Ouija board on it. The son sat in one of the chairs, staring straight ahead. Morbilius came back shortly, calling from the hallway, "She's going to put her gun away if you do, Harry." "I got Junis in front of me. You come in here blazing, you're going to have a dead white man to explain." The two entered. Trudy had a purse, and Harry assumed she'd put the gun in it. She grimaced at seeing Ingram and lied about having Junis as a shield. Morbilius's demeanor remained placid. Ingram took a seat, crossing a leg over the other. "How much?" he said. "You ain't taken it all," Trudy blared. An annoyed Ingram looked at Morbilius. $3 million, Junis estimated, he said. The son remained in the chair, arms folded. "How'd my father figure in all of this?" Morbilius said, "Mrs. Rinaldo said he had an aura." "Jeez," Ingram sneered. Trudy snickered and said, "They met when Junis was driving her from Fort Worth not too long ago. Stopped at a gas station and Roy was working there." "She couldn't afford a plane ticket," Ingram said. "Wanted to see the darn country," Junis said in a low voice from where he sat. "It was a cousin's funeral we'd gone to. Always had me doing some pissant job for her." "But you and Roy knew each other before," Ingram said. "Yeah," Junis said. "We'd been trolleymen when the red car was running." Years ago, Roy Ingram had brought Harry, as a child, and his mother out to Los Angeles to take the trolley job. From the resentment in his voice, Ingram's expression was the son, who'd looked to be in his late 40s, was tired of doing pissant jobs for his mother. He looked at Morbilius and said, "Jones wanted a payday. For a cut, you convinced the old lady, a believer in this hoodoo jive, the banks were going to go under like in the Depression." If Morbilius was surprised, Ingram had gotten a look. His notebook, he didn't let on. "So, how much do you want?" Trudy said. "Junis?" a voice called out. They all went to the master bedroom. In a large padded chair at the writing desk was Mrs. Rinaldo. She was a handsome woman in her 70s, with a mane of long white hair. She was dressed stylishly and rubbed a ringed hand over her face. A glass on a coaster was at her elbow. Ingram understood they doped her like they did him. There was a shopping bag from Bullock's department store near her on the floor, as well as two sizable satchels. "How are you feeling, Mom?" Junis went to her, placing a hand on her shoulder. He glanced at the satchels.
Okay, guess I dozed off.
She patted his face and looked from him to the others. She fixed on Ingram.
Oh, my, doesn't your aura just glow?
Yeah, yes, ma'am, he said, dipping his head as Trudy and Jonas fumed. I'm Roy's son, and he wanted me to tell you he's changed his mind.
As it will be, she said. Please tell me more.
Jonas Binford, Ronaldo had been his mother's second husband, had called Roy at the gas station outside Fort Worth a few weeks after seeing him again. The con hinged on bringing Roy back to town, Ingram said.
Soften up the mother. What with his aura and all, Anita Clare said.
She was back home, and the two sat having coffee in their breakfast nook.
Yep, he said. He told her he'd taken his savings out of the bank and was on his way to Mexico. Once he laid that on her, the son brought Morbilius in who he'd already checked out.
With a wry smile, Claire added, both recognizing the unmistakable aura of greed in the other. Ingram chuckled. Mrs. Ronaldo had previously heard Morbilius's interview on the radio and expressed interest in seeing him for a reading. And he told me he was liberating the money to do good in the community.
Please, she said, your glow is protecting Mrs. Ronaldo?
Well, I talked to Anton yesterday. Anton Spurlock was a lawyer of their acquaintance. He'd calling her today. She already agreed, seeing him at my suggestion. They had more of their coffee.
I don't expect you to forgive why I did what I did, but one day you're going to be old too, Harry. It's getting tiring being without.
Ingram had opened the door to his house, knowing his father was on the other side. They stood in the shallow vestibule. Anita Clare was framed in the doorway to the kitchen, watching them. His father had looked him up in the white pages and called first to ask if it was okay for him to come by.
"Well, guess this is goodbye for now," Roy Ingram said, holding out his hand.
The two shook.
Take care of yourself, son.
Yeah, you too. His father turned and walked back to his car, the Thunderbird with the crinkled fender. He drove away, heading out of town. Anita Clare appeared beside Harry, where he'd leaned in the open doorway, staring out on the street. Arms around each other's waists, they went inside their home, closing the door.
All right, in the few minutes I've got left, another story from the same Elderly Queen Mystery Magazine. Paul Ryan O'Connor writes it, and it's called Destiny.
Why'd you become a bank robber anyway?
Well, because my daddy named me Floyd. How about you?
Well, you can probably guess,
Maynard said, racking his shotgun.
Let's go.
The town was half boarded up, and the Hayseed Bank looked fit to join it. But there'd be some money. Today was when the dirt farmers came in to cash their subsidy checks they got from Roosevelt for not planting their land. That made no sense to Maynard. People not working and getting paid for it while he was out there risking his neck being an outlaw. If the government wouldn't pay him directly, he'd have to take his form from living on relief.
Hands up, everybody, Maynard shouted.
The bank was sleepy, just a single teller and a man behind a desk and a mother holding the hand of her little girl, or was it a boy, next to a potted cactus plant. The boy wore short pants and had long hair. He played with a balloon and chewed gum.
Maynard remembered how his mother put him in short pants and kept his hair long and didn't correct people when they thought he was a little girl. If his daddy had been around, that would have not happened. If his daddy had been around, he might even have gotten bubblegum and a balloon. "Easy there, Mr. Bank Manager," Floyd said, motioning with his revolver at the man behind the desk. "You just stand up real slow." "Now what's your name, Mr. Bank Manager?" Maynard asked. "Franklin Mason," the guy said, his voice even despite guns in his face. "Well now, Franklin Mason, you hear that, Maynard?" Floyd said. "Now that's a name for a bank manager." The little boy popped his bubble gum. Maynard jumped and his finger tightened on the trigger of his shotgun. "Not just a bank manager," Maynard said, trying to sound calm. "That's the name for a president of the United States." "Well, Mr. Bank Manager Franklin Mason, you tell everyone to relax and you'll live to tell your grandkids that you got held up there by Floyd and Maynard," Floyd said. "My partner's going to give your girl his bag and we all want the money."
"Do what he says, Penny," Mason said, speaking to the teller.
The slot was too small, so Maynard handed the bag over the top of the teller's cage. Penny worked quickly, transferring bills from her drawer to the bag. Maynard tried to count as she went. $100, maybe $150, a big score, the first of many for their partnership. Maynard was startled when he caught movement out of the corner of his eye. He whirled around, pointing his shotgun. It was only the kid's balloon bobbing at the end of its string.
"Easy, partner," Floyd said, moving up next to Maynard in front of the cage. He motioned for Penny to hand the bag back over the bars.
Something went bang, and Maynard jerked his trigger, and his shotgun went off, the errant blast carrying away most of Floyd's head. Floyd's body collapsed to the floor, and the bank was silent, save for the little boy startled by the shot and the crying for his balloon popped by the cactus plant. Maynard stood there numbly while the bank manager gently took the shotgun from his hands and passed it through the opening in the cage out of reach. The sheriff came in from where he'd been eating lunch at the drugstore counter across the street. His patrol car was right there at the curb, and Maynard hadn't seen it. He cuffed Maynard and guided him from the bank.
"What's your name, Sheriff?" Maynard asked.
"Randolph Strong," he answered. "Well, that just beat all."
Well, my friends, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour. Keith Tyler saying thank you for joining in, and join me again next time, would you please? Thanks. Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.